You are Locked On Rockets, your daily Houston Rockets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Welcome back to another new episode and a new week here at Locked On Rockets, your podcast home for everything Houston Rockets basketball. I'm your regular host, Ben Dubose, Rockets correspondent with Sports Talk 790, the team's official radio flagship in Houston. I didn't lead off saying, as always, I'm your host because, well, our most recent episode, I was not. I want to begin our show on this Tuesday, July 30th, by thanking my friend Karthik Prasad, Stanford KP on Twitter, for filling in for me this weekend while I was on vacation. He had reaction to the Russell Westbrook press conference on Friday, the official introduction of Russ to Houston. So if you haven't checked that out yet, please go to our Locked On Rockets archives. You can find those wherever you're listening now, in all likelihood. And I thought Karthik did a really nice job hitting the key themes from that news conference. Today, now that I'm back in the fold, we're going to continue our discussion of things that we learned from Friday's availability with Russell Westbrook and GM Daryl Morey. It's actually the first time the Rockets had a truly public news event since they were eliminated back in May by the Warriors in round two of the playoffs. So while, of course, we heard a lot of great things from Russ in terms of his excitement to be in Houston, his willingness to sacrifice. By the way, I thought he was spot on in saying that towards the end of their Oklahoma City career, talking about Westbrook and James Harden, there were times that Harden was the primary ball handler late in games. We saw it when the Thunder knocked off a great San Antonio team in 2012. It was Harden, not Westbrook, that was the primary ball handler late in those games. Russ had to find ways to contribute off the ball. So I thought that was a really nice recall by Russ, and it shows you that his head is in the right place. There was a lot of excitement. And, of course, Karthik talked about a lot of those angles. But in terms of building the team for this coming season and what we hope is a run for a championship here in Houston, of course, it's not just about Russ. It's about Russ, James Harden, and the entire team that surrounds them. And so that's why getting to hear from Daryl Morey, the first true availability to the media this offseason. Now, of course, he's done a select few one-on-one radio interviews, those type of things. But in terms of an actual press conference, taking questions, this was the first opportunity. I'm sad that I missed it because I'm on vacation or was on vacation, Murphy's Law in this instance, but certainly it did help shed some light on the decision-making process for the Rockets. And so tying into what we've deduced as free agency is now almost a month old, what we've seen these first 4 weeks, that's what I'm going to be trying to look at in today's show. In my opinion, the most newsworthy items from the day actually occurred after the press conference. Now, certainly we heard a lot of interesting responses from Daryl and from Russell Westbrook. And in my opinion, perhaps the most interesting angle of all came immediately after the press conference. This was the first time that the Rockets were open, so to speak, to the media. And Dave Hardesty over at Clutch Fans, he's on Twitter simply at Clutch Fans, that's his handle, had some really interesting tweets that I want to discuss in today's show. I'm going to read these in sequential order. This was all within an hour after the press conference concluded on Friday afternoon. Rockets like what they have with their minimum signings, especially with Anthony Bennett. The team is looking at bringing Terrence Jones back, per a source. I asked about Luke Bamute and Vince Carter. The Rockets' current opportunities are more come into camp and earn it, and that isn't currently attractive to those guys. A sign and trade involving Amon Shumpert is still a possibility, but I was told very clearly that it takes two to tango on that. Sounds like Iguodala is more or less being held hostage by Memphis. The asking price is high per source. Rockets did explore options to add salary in the Westbrook trade, which was the holdup, but nothing materialized. Look for the Rockets to stay under the luxury tax line unless something significant opens up. Andre Iguodala would qualify per source. To me, that should have you feeling a lot better about the Rockets under new owner or relative new owner Tillman Fertitta. That, to me, shows you that it's not just superstars or nothing when it comes to the luxury tax. I'm not going to say that you should celebrate because there's still a lot of gray area that we don't know, but it's at least a sigh of relief from my perspective. As I've said, when it comes to the Rockets spending, what we've seen to this point is that there's a line and we just don't know exactly where it is. We know, for example, both last season and this summer, they would have been willing to cross into luxury tax territory for Jimmy Butler. We also know that they would not have if it was something, just say, Patrick Patterson, that was an opportunity to add hypothetical future salary filler in trades down the line, which they could have done in the Westbrook trade with Oklahoma City. So they wouldn't for Patrick Patterson. That's the floor scenario, an expiring $5 to $6 million deal. They would for Jimmy Butler, who's widely considered a top 20, maybe even top 15 player. The question is, what about the tier of role players in the middle? And hearing that they're willing to do it for Iguodala, that is comforting to me. Now, I would not say that you should celebrate it. I wouldn't go that far, because Iguodala, while he is a nice role player, he does have a lot more pedigree than other guys in his class, simply based on all the big shots he's made in the playoffs, being a part of so many championship Golden State teams. So hopefully, even if they can't get Iguodala, the same logic would hold if there's someone that has his comparable skill set when it comes to perimeter defense, perhaps a knack for some timely shooting, off-ball movement, those types of things. Hopefully, if you can get a player like that with a similar skill set, but maybe not the name, Tillman would still be willing to pay the tax. We'll have to wait and see. But as far as Iguodala himself, while he's a nice player, he's certainly not a superstar. No one believes that, not even Max Kellerman. Haha. And to hear that Tillman is willing to do it, that gives me some relief that this organization is willing to go into the tax if they see a clear upgrade to the team. Now, as far as the negotiations and whether the Rockets can actually bring Iguodala to Houston, I said a few weeks ago that the window had passed to trade for Iguodala once the Westbrook trade became official. And the reason I still largely feel that way, at least technically, is that if Memphis had been willing to trade Iguodala to Houston, say for a second round pick, Isaiah Hartenstein, something along those lines, then the amount of salary filler to bridge the gap, you could have used an Iman Shumpert sign and trade with a starting figure of about $6 or $7 million and made the math work, because that extra $9 to $10 million buffer room you had with the 125% rule on salaries you take in with Chris Paul going out and Russell Westbrook coming in. That was the window if there was going to be an Iman Shumpert sign and trade, which in theory is still possible. And it's nice to hear the Rockets have not closed off discussions, even though, as the source told Clutch fans, it takes two to tango. To get back to Iguodala, where this is all connected is that if Memphis was going to take a package involving Iman Shumpert, they would have a lot of egg on their face to take Shumpert at $13 plus million just a few weeks later after they wouldn't take him for six or seven. Now, teams do pull back on their asking prices a lot in the NBA. It takes a deadline to really pressure folks into action. And for Memphis, really, the earliest there's any semblance of a deadline would be closer to training camp in September. And perhaps they drag this out into the season. There's not really a deadline until, well, the trade deadline in early February. So it's possible that it could go on a while, although once you'd have a 35-year-old Andre Iguodala potentially taking minutes, especially if he's a little bit unhappy from younger guys in a rebuilding situation, I could see that putting some pressure. For now, though, in July, August, until we get to September and minutes and training camp reps become a thing, there's not really a lot of pressure, and I highly doubt that Shumpert sticks around. Even if that was an option, I don't know why Iman would pass up employment for this maybe and this hope that Memphis comes back to the table. And I also don't think that Memphis would want the reputation for having that much egg on its face or doing an about face, because in future negotiations, that would set the precedent that you wait these guys out and they'll ultimately cave. It would make them look very silly to overpay Iman Shumpert at $13 million a year, which is what it would take to make the math work on a deal in which the Rockets trade for a $17 million Andre Iguodala. It would look silly for Memphis to do that in a league where there's not really any cap room anymore, just a few weeks after they could have done it for $6 or $7 million. So that's why I think it's nice to have the option, and you never know. It's not as if Memphis is a proven organization. Crazier things have happened, but I would be very skeptical of Memphis doing an about-face that extreme, even if they're asking price does back down a little bit. I don't think that it would go as extreme as all of a sudden, okay, we're willing to do this for a $13 million Iman Shumpert. My guess is that part of the reason that Memphis is holding out for a first is because they know, a first-round pick that is, they know that Iman Shumpert at that dollar figure is so overpaid that from a value standpoint, they should be getting something to take it on, even if it's just a one-year deal. So to me, that's why the window for Iguodala, if that was going to happen in a Shumpert sign and trade, was during the Westbrook acquisition, and I'm sure the Rockets were exploring it, but ultimately the two sides could not come to terms. However, there is another way that the Rockets could land him, and that's by the buyout market. The Rockets do potentially have their non-taxpayer mid-level exception, about $5.5 million left. Now, if they use that, they'd be hard-capped, but as I said on last week's show, just check out our archives, what's the hesitation to using that and hard-capping yourself if you're not planning on going that deep into the tax anyway? It is an option, and it's just a matter of whether Iguodala can extract himself and become a free agent. And as far as whether he'd go to Houston or maybe one of the LA teams like the Clippers or the Lakers, number one, I think the Rockets have more of a hole for minutes. They do need more wing defense. In our minutes exercise last week, I pointed out that you could easily craft a 20 to 25 minutes per game hole based on the roster right now. Conceivably, there could be even more changes down the line. But the point is, with Iguodala's skill set and the Rockets' needs, we know they need help with dribble penetration. There's a path to playing time in Houston that's not there with the LA teams. And perhaps more importantly, there's about $5.5 million that Iguodala, if he was free, could get from the Rockets that he simply could not in LA. Those other teams, the Clippers, the Lakers, we've heard the Nuggets interested as well. I believe all of those squads can only offer the minimum, which is closer to about $2 million. So it's close to three times the salary, definitely more than two and a half here in Houston, and that's a significant leg up. The question is, how and why would he get free? And I do think, after considering this for a few days, there is a path where it makes sense for Memphis and Houston that a deal could still happen, even though it couldn't during the Westbrook window. That's why I've had such a hard time seeing the trade scenarios, because every one of them, you know, in theory, there's a cap mechanism that could make a deal work. But I wonder the entire while, okay, if both sides, Memphis and Houston, were willing to do that, why wouldn't it have happened during the Westbrook negotiations in mid-July when the threshold was a lot lower math-wise to make a deal work? That's why I can't see a pure trade materializing. However, there is a hybrid that could get Andre Iguodala to Houston. And it could be that Memphis allows Iguodala and his agent to talk to other teams, maybe this is already happening, to get a feel for what he wants to do, and then Memphis agrees to buy him out as a condition, an unofficial condition, of course, it can't be written into the legalese, but basically an unofficial condition of a separate trade. What I mean by that is the Rockets could theoretically trade, say, a second-round pick, Isaiah Hartenstein, and some cash to the Grizzlies in exchange for a heavily protected second-round pick that's unlikely to ever convey. Say protected unless it's in the 55 to 60 range, which is extremely unlikely. So in that event, it just converts to cash or nothing down the road. And as an unofficial condition of that trade, the Grizzlies would reach a buyout with Andre Iguodala, and then Iggy would choose the Rockets. In this hypothetical, I don't think the Rockets would give up those assets, even if it's not a first-round pick, without having word from Iguodala and his agent that this is where he wants to be. Now, I'm sure some of you are probably wondering, why would the Grizzlies do this if they're holding out for a first in these other negotiations? The reason, in my opinion, is because in those other negotiations, you are asking the Grizzlies to take on $13 million in bad money. That would be an overpay for Iman Shumpert. Whereas in this deal, you're not asking them to take on bad money. Now, they would be having to buy out Andre Iguodala. That would be money that they're basically throwing away. However, there are two reasons why that's more advantageous to Memphis than taking on Shumpert at $13 million. For starters, if Iguodala is making about $5.5 million with the Rockets, then I presume he would give back that much in a buyout with Memphis. So you could subtract basically his $17 million salary and make that about $11.5 million. Then the Rockets could throw in, each team has their own cash allotment every year, beginning July 1st, it's every fiscal year. the Rockets could throw in, say, $3 or $4 million into the trade, and that takes that $11.5 million figure all the way down to about $7.5 million. Maybe if Memphis only has a net impact of giving away $7.5 million, maybe in that scenario, they're willing to accept something other than a first-round pick, like a second and Isaiah Hartenstein, or 2 seconds, something like that. That's a lot more reasonable for the Grizzlies than asking them to pay Iman Shumpert $13 million and not get a first for doing so. You are reducing what their obligations are. And from the Rockets' standpoint, it's actually better for Houston as well. Because with the Rockets, if they do a trade this way without picking up Iguodala on his existing salary, then you're only paying him about $5.5 million, which on the luxury tax, it's more than that, but it's a lot less than if you're paying him $17 million, which is what you would be if you were doing a Shumpert sign and trade. So for both sides, the Grizzlies and the Rockets, it is friendlier financially if you can work a trade independent of actually having Andre Iguodala on his existing $17 million deal. So that's why I could see a pathway. It would take getting creative, but certainly Daryl Morey is, to where this could still work. And for Iguodala, there's no real downside. He'd still be getting the same money. Now, technically, Houston would not have his bird rights. By doing this, he'd be on a new deal, so they would only be able to offer him, I believe, a slight raise over the $5.5 million he'd be making. So about $6 million next summer, 6 to 7 would be the range they could offer him to re-sign, as opposed to having bird rights on him at $17 million if they got his existing deal. But how much are bird rights really worth for a 36-year-old Andre Iguodala? That's my question. I could see this being friendlier to all sides, the Grizzlies and the Rockets. Financially, Houston doesn't really need the bird rights for a 36-year-old Iggy anyway. I would suspect that $6.5 million-ish would be enough to re-sign if he proves worth that with his performance this season. And as far as Iguodala is concerned, as long as he's getting the $17 million, why does he care if he's getting it all from, say, Houston or wherever he's traded to, or Memphis if he stays, versus getting, say, $11 million from the Grizzlies in a buyout and $5.5 million from the Rockets in a new contract? To me, that's the realistic pathway to a deal. I don't know that it's going to happen, but it's at least possible. And Houston would have a leg up, because even if Iguodala would want another situation more, like the Clippers, the Lakers, the Nuggets, something like that, and I'm not clear that any of those teams can offer more minutes or more of a defined role than Houston, but even if Andre wanted to be there, I don't know that there's a pathway for Memphis, given its desires, to have it work for both sides. Because in those scenarios, Iguodala's buyout request from Memphis would probably be a lot higher, because all he'd be getting in his new contract is the minimum rather than what's left of the non-taxpayer MLE, about $5.5 million. That's a pretty significant difference. So if Iguodala wanted to go to one of those other teams, he would have to give back a lot of money. So that's what gives me a lot of hope when it comes to Iggy and the Rockets. I don't expect it to happen anytime soon. Again, there's no time pressure other than training camp. So in theory, could it happen this week? Sure. It could also drag on into September, like, say, the Carmelo Anthony negotiations 2 years ago. And it could take Iguodala being within a few days of training camp to actually spur one or both sides into action, because there's a lot of negotiations that would have to go on here, not just between the Grizzlies and the Rockets or whatever team would be acquiring Iguodala, but also buyout talks, having Iggy and his agent be able to speak with other teams to figure out what he could get on the open market, which would then correlate with what he's willing to give up in a buyout in all likelihood. It may not take up until the day before training camp, but there are a lot of moving pieces here, so it's probably going to take some time, and there's not that much pressure anyway until September, so I'm not anticipating it happen anytime soon. I think the Rockets are happy with what they have for the time being, but hearing the report that the Rockets are willing to go into the luxury tax for a role player like Andre Iguodala, well, according to Dave Hardesty, Iguodala specifically, that's encouraging. That tells me that it can still happen. There's no guarantee that it will, but there is a path, in my opinion, if the Rockets are willing to go into the tax, that a deal could still happen, even though it didn't materialize when what seemed to be the perfect window, the Westbrook trade, was there earlier this month. All right, welcome back to the program. This is Locked on Rockets. I'm your host, Ben Dubose. In today's show, on this Tuesday, July 30th, we're looking back at the press conference that was last Friday introducing Russell Westbrook to Houston, and more importantly, looking at the news that came out of that event, both during when Daryl Morey and Russ himself spoke, and also after when a lot of reports leaked about what the Rockets' plans are, or at least potential plans, for the remainder of the offseason. Segment one, we looked at the more high-profile plan or possibility, that being Andre Iguodala, former 3-and-D stud with the Golden State Warriors, now with the Memphis Grizzlies, a rebuilding situation. At some point, everyone expects him to move on to a contender. There's no real reason for the Grizzlies to have a 35-year-old Iguodala around. He's only there because the Warriors had to get beneath the hard cap in order to do a sign-and-trade of Kevin Durant for D'Angelo Russell to get some value for departing KD. And because of the time pressures needing to get it done on July 1st, the Grizzlies were able to extract a first for taking on Iguodala. Now they're trying to pull off the rare double of somehow getting a first-round pick for taking Iggy and then landing a first-round pick for trading him and teams seeing him as a positive asset. In my opinion, that's probably a reach, and I think Memphis on some level knows that. I think the reports, and this is my brief summary of what we discussed a few moments ago in segment one, I think the reports that Memphis is looking for a first-round pick are largely because the types of salaries being offered to make the math work on an Andre Iguodala who makes nearly $17 million per season, well, it's a one-year deal, he's expiring this coming year. Well, if you're taking back, say, Courtney Lee from Dallas, that's one rumored proposal, he's $12-plus million, a one-year deal. Or Iman Shumpert, and the sign-and-trade we've discussed involving the Rockets for a few weeks, that option, he'd be making close to $13 million a year. That's bad money. So the request from the Grizzlies for a first-round pick, it's not just about what Iggy can command. It's that if we're taking on, and when I say we, I'm referring to the Grizzlies' mindset, if we're taking on a player like Courtney Lee or Iman Shumpert, who's not that good and doesn't make a whole lot of sense for us at $12, $13 million, then you should give us a first-round pick to compensate. As I see it, the road around that that could work potentially for the Rockets, since they have about $5.5 million of their non-taxpayer mid-level exception, should they choose to use it, still left, would be for the Rockets and Grizzlies to negotiate a trade independent of Iguodala himself, basically making a buyout from Memphis of Iggy, an unofficial condition of it. And so Memphis could get, say, a couple of second-round picks or Isaiah Hartenstein and a pick, all while not taking on the bad money that would be required if Iggy himself were a part of the deal and the Rockets or any team above the cap had to match salaries. In this way, the Grizzlies could get some young assets, maybe not a first, maybe it's a second or two, and then buying out Iggy at a lower figure, especially if it's the Rockets, because they have $5.5 million left of their non-taxpayer MLE. That, in turn, should give the Grizzlies more of an argument to get Iggy to accept less in a buyout. And then at that point, you're not tying yourself in with as much bad money as you would with Courtney Lee or Iman Shumpert at the values that have been discussed. And that's especially the case if the Rockets can insert some cash into the trade to further help cover the payments that go to Iguodala as part of his buyout. So that could be the compromise scenario. And that's why I'm sure many listening to this are saying, why would the Grizzlies go from wanting a first for Iguodala to buying him out? Isn't that extreme? Well, it's not so extreme when you consider that the first that they're demanding, it's not so much that they see that Iguodala, this guy that they just got a first for taking on, as worth that by himself. They're asking for the first because the deals proposed to this point are asking the Grizzlies to take on bad money. If they're not taking on bad money, then my guess is that the request goes down a whole heck of a lot. And at that point, maybe even a buyout is feasible if you can get them some assets in other ways. Stay tuned. Anyway, the Iggy pursuit, that's more high profile. That's certainly not the be-all, end-all when it comes to the Rockets the rest of this offseason and filling out the roster around James Harden and Russell Westbrook. We heard from Dave Hardesty at Clutch Fans. He had some great intel after the press conference. The Rockets are trying to bring in Terrence Jones. They had him for a couple of weeks this past season. I know that name former Rocket, of course, from earlier this decade, relative disappointment after earning the starting power forward spot early in his career. I know it's not one that's going to jump off the page and attract a lot of headlines, but you can see what the Rockets are looking for. Similar to Anthony Bennett, these are probably the two best stretch bigs in the G League. They're athletic, but the most important thing with both of those guys is that they have range all the way out to behind the three-point arc. And I think in a Mike D'Antoni system, I wouldn't rule out them playing some four, but generally this is a scheme in which you see players play up a position because of the dependence on speed, floor spacing, being able to defend and switch, although we'll see exactly how Elston Turner chooses to run his defense relative to Jeff Bezdelic. The Warriors aren't the Warriors anymore either, so perhaps they don't switch quite as much as they have in recent years, and maybe that changes the position requirements a little bit. But from what we've seen through the first three Mike D'Antoni years in Houston, I would bet that while they're not ruling out the four spot for guys like Bennett or Terrence Jones, I think more reasonably it would be like when the Rockets brought in Kenneth Faried in the middle of last season, in which you see them as an alternative to your more traditional five. In other words, if Nene and now Tyson Chandler needs a day off to rest, or they think a matchup isn't conducive to that traditional skill set, then maybe they want to go smaller, more athletic, more energetic, and also, in the case of Bennett and Jones, superior shooting. We saw that at times last year with Faried, who's been working on his three-point shot, and early in his Rockets tenure, that was back in February, we actually saw Faried make a few threes, and it was a revelation as far as his time at the five when he was doing that. I think that's what the Rockets want with Jones and Anthony Bennett. Of course, they're reclamation projects. I know both, and especially Bennett, the former 2013 number one overall pick. We talked about him a lot in last week's show. They're known as bust, but they're also guys that are still in their 20s. And so there's still a lot of upside to each of them. They've proven by going to the G League level that they have the right mentality. That's not something that guys do if they aren't committed to trying to make it work. If you're worried about their motor or their mental state, typically those guys don't have the humility to go down a level and really prove it for a year, which both of these guys did playing the majority of this past season at the G League, that they still have what it takes to be an NBA player. So the odds are definitely still against them. There's a reason why these guys largely failed the first time, at least through the prism of being a rotation player. They're certainly not failures as basketball players. Anything that you can contribute at the NBA level is way better than the vast majority of the basketball playing population, certainly myself included. Let's be clear about that. When we say disappointment, it's all through the lens of relativity and what it takes to be a starter or a rotation player at the NBA level. As far as Bennett and Jones, they're lottery tickets, but I think you can see what they're looking for. It's not just the athleticism and size, that's a part of it. You do want depth, but you also want shooting. I think that's where the Rockets are trying to get better. They want more diversity when it comes to their options at the end of that bench. If you have a Tyson Chandler in his late 30s, year 19 as your backup center, and you know at his age he's going to need some days off regardless of matchups, then it doesn't make sense to have a carbon copy of a guy like that behind him. What you want when you're filling out the end of your bench is to be able to mix and match. You want some contrast. And so I think these two guys, and it's helpful to have two rather than one. Now, as I'm recording this podcast late on Tuesday, the Terrence Jones deal is not official. This was just reported by Dave Hardesty at Clutch Fans, and it was mentioned again by Kelly Eco, Rockets beat writer for The Athletic, in his column on Monday. But assuming that happens, and I have to think that it will, it seems pretty random for the Rockets to leak that name if it's not something that they felt confident in closing. I know neither of those two are sexy names that if you had been told in June, you'd be excited about. But from an X's and O's standpoint, you can see what Daryl Morey is thinking. You can see how they can fit. Now it's on them in training camp to prove worthy of this chance that they're going to be given. Now, I don't think either will be given much of a guarantee. They're going to have to go out and prove in training camp and in the preseason that they're worthy of the opportunity. But at least from a talent standpoint, not just the fact that they're tall and they're athletic, and at one point they were former first-round picks, number one overall in Anthony Bennett's case. Beyond that, they do have a skill that's intriguing between the athleticism and the shooting, the ability to play in space. It's a big with another dimension than Tyson Chandler. So when you're looking at your backups behind Clint Capella, perhaps even your backup behind PJ Tucker as well, if Elston Turner and Mike D'Antoni choose to go a little bit bigger than they have in past years. Certainly at the five, maybe the four as well, but it's another dimension. I think we can see what the Rockets are looking for. Now, will both of those guys pan out? The odds are against it. I think you consider yourself lucky if one of the two does. But I think in the grand scheme, number one, your odds are better if you have two chances rather than one. And even if neither hits, then I do think it shows you a little bit about what the Rockets are prioritizing. It's not just about a certain body type. It's also about a skill set. And so I think the shooting out of the bigs, certainly with Russell Westbrook and James Harden, having shooting around them is important. We heard Westbrook several times in his press conference reference the shooters in Houston, and he didn't say it, but it was pretty clear that he was drawing a contrast with what he's had in Oklahoma City, in which the spacing around him was not always ideal for his drives. Well, you can see with the additions of Anthony Bennett and Terrence Jones, even though it's on a much smaller scale, you can see what Daryl Morey is looking for. And even if, for whatever reason, one or both of these guys don't work out, and I do think it tells you what the Rockets are looking for as far as those end-of-the-bench options, especially up front, as they conclude this offseason and as they try and add more during the season, should these two, for whatever reason, not work out. The other interesting takeaway that we learned Friday, and this is also going back to the string of tweets from Dave Hardesty at Clutch Fans on Twitter, was when the source was asked about Luke Bamute and Vince Carter, and specifically that the Rockets' opportunities now will more come in and earn it. It's not about the money, because all of these guys are pretty much playing for the minimum now. There's almost no cap room left. But as I said last week when we dove into this topic, the Rockets right now, with just their top eight, the five starters, well, the four we know, Westbrook, Harden, PJ Tucker, Clint Capella, and then whichever of Eric Gordon and Daniel House, well, then you have whichever of Gordon and House does not start on the bench, along with Austin Rivers and Tyson Chandler. Just between those eight, and that's before we even mention guys like Gerald Green, who was a double-figure scorer each of the last 2 years, or I believe on average, I think he was slightly below that a season ago. But even before mentioning Gerald, just with the top eight, it's hard to carve out a clear pathway to minutes. So when you're looking at guys like Bamute and Vince Carter, yeah, on paper, those would be great fits if you could have those types of options at the end of your bench. But what's really difficult, and I'll talk a bit more about this in our third segment coming up, when we look at some of the more intangible aspects of things the Rockets have done of late, specifically the Westbrook acquisition. One thing when it comes to crafting the appropriate culture in a locker room is to have level expectations. Chemistry is certainly a priority. In the 65-win season 2 years ago, the Rockets did a better job of building that chemistry than they did last year when they got off to that 11-14 start, and ultimately it put them behind the eight ball. That's why they were only the four seed instead of the first or the second, and had a lot to do with what happened in the playoffs. Not having home court advantage absolutely took a toll in their round two loss when the home team won five of the six games. The Rockets are prioritizing chemistry, and when you're looking at these more proven types, Bamute and Vince Carter were the names mentioned in Hardesty's tweet, but you could probably throw J.R. Smith into the mix as well. It's a lot to ask for guys that are proven NBA rotation players, that have done it for the vast majority of their professional lives, to play for the minimum at all. Then to ask them to both play for the minimum and not have an obvious minutes floor, that's a ton to ask of these guys. And whatever the upside is of bringing in someone like that, that's a little more proven, say, than an Anthony Bennett or Terrence Jones, if we're talking about someone at the four or the five, for example, whatever upside there is to a little bit more proven production for maybe the 10 to 12 minutes on occasion that's available, it's dwarfed by the downside of there being a chemistry risk if one of these guys isn't happy with their minutes. That's part of why the Rockets let Carmelo Anthony go after just 10 games a season ago. It wasn't that the Rockets didn't think Carmelo could be a decent option as the 10th, 11th, 12th man on the bench. He showed you enough early last year that in the appropriate matchups, he could be a positive. I think he scored close to 30 in one of the first games in Brooklyn, and that was a win last October. The problem is that if Melo wasn't going to consistently play, they didn't want it to become a situation in which he was then unhappy in the locker room and it took a toll on morale, the chemistry, however you want to define it, that was already lagging a little bit. It's a lot to ask to begin with, these proven players, to have to accept a true league minimum deal. To then ask them to accept the league minimum without guaranteeing any minutes at all, The only reason why most of these guys would accept the minimum, they look at it as somewhat of a slap in the face, and you can understand why, and they want to prove themselves so that they're not minimum guys a year from now. They want a pathway to minutes so that they can play 15 to 20 minutes a game and reestablish their value for future seasons. In Houston, it's not just that the Rockets can only offer the minimum, they also can't really offer that many guaranteed minutes. Now, there could be a point in which one or more of these guys comes back to the table and says, hey, you know what? I'm willing to accept the minimum, no guarantee of minutes. And if that's the case, sure, I think the Rockets would happily take the gamble, because even if later on they get an indication that the player is upset despite what he says, well, you can just cut bait. It's a minimum contract. We saw them do that with both Carmelo Anthony and Michael Carter-Williams a season ago. It's not all that difficult to pivot when it comes to these minimum salaries. But for now, there's no reason for the player to sign in Houston, and there's no reason for Houston to sign them or to try to if there's this huge question with regards to the player's expectation and what Houston can offer not really meshing with their preferred version of reality. It could change as the offseason progresses, and oftentimes these negotiations, if a player has to go 6 to 8 weeks without signing, it can kind of be like a dose of humility. And perhaps one of these guys comes back to the table and says, hey, I'm fine not having a guarantee of X amount of minutes. I'll come in and prove it. Just give me the opportunity. And I think that's where the Rockets are at. I speculated that last week, and it sounds like from the Dave Hardesty tweets that that's exactly where we are. The Rockets, could they use more depth? Sure. Absolutely, and I would love it if they had one more proven type guy, a J.R. Smith, a Luke Bob Mute, a Vince Carter. I would welcome that. But whatever small upgrade there is from, say, Gerald Green to one of those, or maybe if you're going super small, one of those types over an Anthony Bennett or a Terrence Jones, whatever the small upgrade is, it's not worth it if there's a downside risk because the player wouldn't be happy in that role and his expectations would not be met by how Mike D'Antoni and his staff then choose to use him. It's not just about alignment from a talent perspective and what the Rockets need. That matters if you're talking about an Andre Iguodala, a guy who's clearly going to play, and so you know you need a certain skill set, and with this player clearly having that, then you're going to find a way to get him minutes. When it comes to these minimum guys who are basically just depth adds, you have to make sure that it's not just about the talent, it's also about the mental side. Whatever small boost they'd give you in terms of potential minutes or feeling better about your options at the 10, 11 spots on the roster, it's not worth it if it could potentially be a huge negative in other areas such as the culture, the vibe, what you're trying to build chemistry-wise in the locker room. So I think that's why the Rockets are going to be patient. I'm not going to say that it's not going to happen, because all it takes is one conversation. One of these guys can say, hey, even if you don't give me guaranteed minutes, I just want to be there. I see the Rockets as a contender. I'm happy to earn my way. The Rockets could absolutely try that, and I hope that happens. But for now, I wouldn't refresh Twitter every single day. My guess is that if that happens, we're probably talking more about weeks than we are days. And with any luck, the Rockets closer to training camp will get a more proven option that's willing to make that type of sacrifice. But will it happen in the closing days of July or the first few of August? I'd be happy if it did, but I would be lying if I said I expected it. I would say keep your expectations low on that front. Be happy with what we've heard to this point, including Terrence Jones. As I explained, I think that's likely to happen. And then treat anything else on the minimum front that transpires as a bonus should that occur at a later date. All right, final thoughts on this Tuesday, July 30th here at Locked On Rockets. As always, I'm your host, Ben Dubose. In today's show, we're looking back at what we learned last Friday during the Russell Westbrook introductory press conference, along with a number of reports that came out after it, most notably from Dave Hardesty at Clutch Fans about the Rockets, their priorities, the remainder of the offseason. A lot of juicy, newsworthy tidbits came out. It was the first time the Rockets had a media availability this offseason. I hate that I missed it because I was on vacation. Murphy's Law, what can go wrong does sometimes, but I am happy that the news is at least out there, even if I wasn't able to be there myself. I do think we learned a lot, and so we spent the first couple of segments recapping what I see as the main news takeaways, and again, hat tip to Dave Hardesty at Clutch Fans for tremendous work in digging out all of this information from sources within the Rockets' front office. Anyway, the third and final segment. I haven't talked too much about what Russell Westbrook said himself, because if you check out our Locked On Rockets archives, our show over the weekend by Karthik Prasad, I thought Karthik Stanford KP on Twitter did a great job hitting the key takeaways, the key topics and themes, what we heard from Westbrook and Daryl Morey on that stage at Toyota Center. I thought that he really nailed what the most obvious and influential takeaways were from that availability. The one thing that I want to stress, and Karthik discussed this a little bit, but I want to talk about it even more in the context of what we just went through in segment two, talking about the chemistry risk of bringing in guys who aren't really certain that they'd be happy in the role or minutes or lack thereof in Houston. And chemistry is important. We saw that last year when the 11-14 start, the Rockets' talent was always better than that. But at some point you are what your record says you are. And that was a lot to overcome, even though they played on a 60 plus win pace over the final three quarters of the season. The Rockets are definitely prioritizing having a better vibe, a better culture, better chemistry once training camp begins in September and the season in October. And on that front, from a bigger picture standpoint, the best thing that I saw in the entire press conference on Friday, and really the entire day when we look at the pictures and videos that the Rockets shared on their social media channels, was the happiness of James Harden. He was there to support Ross, perhaps what was most noteworthy. James was in the front row with the media in those seats in the press conference room. James was there, and a lot of stars, you know, they'll take an opportunity with the entire world watching this press conference to grow their brand. James didn't. He wanted it to be all about Russ. He was there, and yet he didn't even want to speak. He deflected and he gave the stage to Russell Westbrook because it was his day. But yet, even with it being Westbrook's day and him having the stage, Harden just wanted to be there to take it all in and to show his support. That's a big deal. There are legitimate questions from a basketball fit standpoint about how Westbrook is going to be relative to Chris Paul. We've talked about it the last few weeks on this show, and I'm sure we'll do it more the rest of the offseason until we actually start getting game evidence of how the fit seems to be between Harden and Westbrook, and really Westbrook and Mike D'Antoni and the rest of the Rockets in this system. All of that is speculative. But what we know as we enter August 2019, and I think it's huge from the standpoint of team chemistry, morale, those factors that we've been discussing, is that this makes James Harden happy. And there is a lot of value in that. Now, I don't think that Harden was planning to ask for a trade or anything extreme. He's under contract for four more seasons, and by all accounts, he's not looking to leave Houston. There's a reason why he has not even put Houston through a free agency and now his 7 years here. That's why I said when the Westbrook trade broke back on, I believe it was July 11th, there was a very easy way to get on board, and it's that it was James Harden's play. In all of his 7 years, he's been not just a great basketball player, but he's been very loyal, and this was his opportunity. In this NBA where stars are teaming up, we've seen it with Kawhi and Paul George, with LeBron and Anthony Davis. Chris Paul and Dwight Howard, those were superstar-level acquisitions, but they were basically the best player on the market at the time. They were marriages of convenience. This was James Harden's hand-picked guy. And certainly going back to their career in Oklahoma City together, what we know about them as teammates back then and now friends off the floor, it's easy to speculate that Harden would like it. And of course, there were reports that he was a big part of the negotiations. We heard from Daryl during the press conference that someone asked Daryl how quickly it came together, and Morey quickly responded, not fast enough for James, which of course tells you how much that Harden wanted it to happen. But folks, that's a really big deal. I don't think that Harden wanted out of Houston, but to have your star player fully engaged and ready and excited, the smile on his face heading into training camp, that means a whole heck of a lot. I don't know that Russell Westbrook will be responsible for bringing a title to Houston. I firmly believe that if the Rockets win a title next season or any year, really, in this era, it's going to be because of James Harden. James is going to be the best player on the team. Well, regardless of what you think about Westbrook's fit, and I hope he does help the team overall, if the only thing he does is bring out the best in James Harden, then that's still doing a whole heck of a lot. because James Harden is the guy that's going to determine from a 30,000 foot view standpoint whether Houston can win a championship. So doing things to boost the mental health, the happiness of your star player, that's not irrelevant. What's interesting about it is if you juxtapose it with some of these other silly media reports we've seen this offseason about the Rockets being allegedly cold and calculating, that type of stuff. No, the Rockets do value the intangibles, the human side. After all, you talk about building chemistry. The best way to build good chemistry in any organization is get people that want to be there and are happy, especially if they're at the top of the food chain, which James Harden, as basically a four-time top two MVP player and should be three-time MVP over the past three seasons, that guy is at the top of the list in Houston when it comes to the importance of building culture and the guy that sets the tone for everyone else. And when you look at some of these reports that paint the Rockets in such a cold and calculating light, it's just so funny to look at those and then consider the reality of moves the Rockets have made that on paper are a little bit questionable. Because sure, from a pure X's and O's standpoint, it's a little easier to see how Harden and Chris Paul meshed than it is Harden and Westbrook at this point in their careers, with over the past 3 years, these being two of the highest usage guys that we've seen in a long time in the NBA. But one reason why the Rockets are willing to take the gamble and to give up two future first-round picks that are largely unprotected in the process is because of the impact that it has on James Harden's state of mind. That is something that's been clear from the outset. It's even more evident after Friday. I'm certainly happy that he's happy on a superficial level. Harden's been a great guy in Houston, so I want to see him smiling and having a good time. He's given so much back to the fans, the community, those types of things. But also, from the standpoint of building the best basketball team, it's relevant. It's a factor. And we've seen the Rockets do this in the past as well. This three-year run in which he's been three straight years, top two in MVP voting, and I believe he should have won it all 3 years, did win it in 2018. Two of the 3 years, the Rockets had a guy at the end of the bench, a former podcast guest, by the way, Bobby Brown, that definitely on paper did not fit the mold and does not fit the mold for what Daryl Morey typically does at the end of his bench. We talked about in segment two, Anthony Bennett, and then if the Rockets, as rumored, bring in Terrence Jones. These are typically the end of the bench options that Daryl Morey brings in. Guys that are younger, have more upside, they may have non-guaranteed contracts because they're relatively unproven. To have a guy in his 30s like Bobby Brown as your 11th or 12th man, that doesn't really mesh. This is just a smaller example, but it doesn't really mesh with the Daryl Morey philosophy from a basketball standpoint. There's not a ton of upside. It's a guy who, in the case of Bobby Brown, sure, he's a nice scorer, hashtag what your ones look like, but at times he can be a little bit of a ball stopper, which as a point guard around James Harden and at times Chris Paul is not really what you're looking for. He's not a great defender or an asset on that side of the floor. In his 30s, it's not like there's a path to which he's clearly going to get better. So if it were just about, okay, what's the best use of this roster spot in terms of maximizing its value down the line, you probably would spend that roster spot on someone younger that you could develop rather than a Bobby Brown in his 30s who's probably not going to play. Yet the Rockets had him around for two seasons, and they only let him go when they absolutely had to create a roster spot for Gerald Green, who they signed right after Christmas in 2017, and he played so well, they had to find a way to keep him. And even after that, the Rockets were looking at ways to bring Bobby back until they had a lot of success in the buyout market that year. That was the 65-win team, which put the Rockets at the front of the line, and they ended up signing Joe Johnson and Brandon Wright as buyouts. The reason I'm highlighting this smaller-scale Bobby Brown example, it goes against what Daryl Morey typically does at the end of his bench for guys who aren't going to play. Yet they did it. And the biggest reason why? We all know it. It's because he's incredibly tight with James Harden. Those two are friends, and from a basketball standpoint, from a personal standpoint, there's a mentorship, but there's also just a kinship, a brotherhood. And I do believe that Bobby, even though he didn't play that much, he had a big role in putting Harden in the right frame of mind, and he was a big part of their culture in that great 65-win season when he and Trevor were together so much. We saw that, I believe it was the game that Ariza was suspended. We all remember the Instagram clips that Bobby posted of Ariza celebrating. That was when the Rockets beat the Warriors that Saturday game in January. And of course, Bobby was there the season before as well, when the Rockets went from 41-41, a team that a lot of people didn't even know would make the playoffs, to all of a sudden 55 wins, the top three seed in the West with Harden as the only superstar, no Chris Paul that year. I'm not giving all the credit to Bobby, but what I'm saying is that the Rockets prioritized in those years having the right vibe in their clubhouse, in that locker room, and Bobby was a part of it. Even though on paper, he isn't a guy that fits with the traditional Daryl Morey mold of this is what I want for my end-of-the-bench roster spots to give me the best chance at potentially hitting or maximizing the value. So that's interesting to keep in mind as you look at this Westbrook-Harden dynamic. Obviously, Russell Westbrook, he's going to play. This is a much, much larger scale than Bobby Brown. I'm not comparing Bobby Brown to Russell Westbrook. That's a much smaller example. But where I do think there is some common ground is that both moves, and there have been others as well, but these are just a couple that I do think show you that the Rockets, they do value the human element, the intangibles. It's not all cold and calculating what's turned out on a spreadsheet for who could be the best fit for this particular roster spot. No, beyond those angles, there is a human element that's considered. This is a much larger experiment than having Bobby Brown as your 11th or 12th man. But the similar dynamic is that it's done, in part at least, because of the effect that it has on James Harden. And bringing out the best in James Harden more than anything else, that's going to have the tightest correlation with whether the Houston Rockets can win an NBA championship. That's not the only factor. And the fit question, the X's and O's with Westbrook, those are all very valid. And we'll see how that plays out over the next few months and honestly, years with Russell's contract, still 4 years, $170 million left. Tillman Fertitta deserves more credit than he's gotten, by the way, for taking on that contract. That's why some of the critiques are definitely overdone, but that's a completely different discussion. As far as what I wanted to hit in this, our third and final segment, do not discount the value of having a really happy James Harden. Superficially, for a guy that's done so much for this franchise and the Houston community, it's great. But also from a basketball standpoint, in terms of building the type of contender that all of us want, having a fully bought-in James Harden, now again, I don't think before that he was going to ask for a trade or anything extreme like that, but doing something to boost the happiness of your meal ticket, which James Harden is, don't overlook that element. To me, just as impactful as anything that was said by Daryl Morey and Russell Westbrook, I thought Karthik Prasad recapped it well. Just as important as any of that was what we saw throughout the day from James Harden. The degree of buy-in that we've had from the former MVP, that is massive. And so even if you have some skepticism over exactly what the Westbrook fit is and will be, that's fair. But the one thing that I think we can all agree on, and it's where I'll leave you on this extended Tuesday show, be happy that James Harden is happy. Because that absolutely has a lot of relevance when it comes to the end game for these Houston Rockets. Anyway, with that, I think we can put a bow on tonight's show on this Tuesday, July 30th, here at Lockdown Rockets. And if you want more content before our next show, there are, of course, many ways that you can get that. First and foremost is Twitter, where I'm on there at Ben Dubose, and the show is on there at Lockdown Rockets. But beyond that, we've got a website, lockdownrockets.com, a Facebook account at facebook.com/lockdownrockets, an email address, lockdownrockets@gmail.com. All of those are ways that you can access prior episodes, or you can ask me questions about the team, make suggestions for the show, those types of things. And in addition to checking out our Lockdown Rockets archives, please remember that to get this show every day, the best way is to subscribe. One way is with Himalaya's new podcast app, which offers personally curated playlists and new features each and every single day. You can also listen and subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and more. And I encourage you to do so and to leave 5-star reviews wherever you can. That's how we can look attractive to potential sponsors and keep the business model rolling as the most regular podcast covering Houston Rockets basketball. And remember that when you go to your car or you get into the gym, you can even tell your smart device to play podcast Lockdown Rockets and listen to our most recent episodes that way as well. Once again, I'm Ben Dubose. Thanks to all of you for listening. And please come back soon for more episodes right here at Lockdown Rockets, your podcast home for everything Houston Rockets basketball.